Blocked at the border, a judge in El Paso puts the brakes again on part of the president's border wall project, though parts of the wall still going up. Details today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. We'll have more on the latest legal challenge to the president's effort to fulfill his campaign promise of a border wall from the Gulf to the Pacific. Also, a battle in the Texas capital city over changes to the code may be the shape of things to come for the rest of Texas. We'll hear why. And 2019, a good year for cybersecurity. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga gets us up to speed and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 12th day of December 2019. My, the month is moving fast. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. As much of the nation focuses on a certain matter of impeachment, there is something happening somewhat closer to home that far fewer people have heard about. Now, you may recall President Trump's campaign pledge to build that wall, a literal border wall along the southernmost dividing line with Mexico. You may further recall that when Congress failed to come through with the funds the president asked for in order to make that wall happen, the president declared a national emergency. That was last February. He's trying to transfer funds from the Pentagon to build that wall. You may even recall that the Supreme Court ruled back in July that the Trump administration could access a pot of $2.5 billion from a Pentagon counter-narcotics fund to pay for wall construction, what was considered at the time a major victory for Mr. Trump. Now a blow to the president's efforts to build that wall, and Nick Miroff is covering this story. Nick is an immigration reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome back to the Texas Standard. Nick, good to talk with you.
Thanks, David. Good to be with you.
What was the argument behind the judge's decision to apparently block Pentagon funding that the Trump administration was planning on using for border wall construction?
This district court judge in El Paso blocked the administration's access to this specific pot of money. It's $3.6 billion in Pentagon construction money. And he said that the administration did not have the authority to take this money that wasn't appropriated by Congress. And that specific pot of money was supposed to pay for about 175 linear miles of border wall. And all of that is going to be a setback to Trump's pledge to complete 450 miles by the end of next year.
So how does that square with what the Supreme Court did back in July, where they said that the Trump administration could access a pot of money from that Pentagon counter-narcotics fund?
Well, this is going to be the basis for the government's appeal. That appeal is going to go to the Fifth Circuit, which is one of the more conservative circuits, as I understand. And I think the government is pretty confident that it will prevail. However, this may end up going back to the Supreme Court, and we will once more be faced with this question again of whether or not the president exceeded his authority to take these funds for this project.
Something else, though, that I'm not clear about. This seems similar to a case that came out of California, where a federal judge also blocked the use of military funds for border wall construction. That's the case that the Supreme Court had earlier ruled on. Is that right?
Correct. You know, what we're seeing is that there are multiple challenges to the administration's plans in different courts, and all of it is leading to this kind of patchwork of decisions and putting more pressure, I think, on the Supreme Court to, you know, really settle this question once and for all. And, you know, it's going to delay the administration's ability to meet the president's stated objective of 450 miles. These contracts have to be awarded months in advance, at least, in order for the, you know, the crews to get out there and start putting this thing up. So it's all going to, you know, cast a bit more doubt on his promise to reach that benchmark.
And yet, Nick, I've been reading some stories that say portions of this wall have been going up. What's known about the border wall construction thus far?
So they've built more than 90 miles so far, and they are working in multiple locations. Almost all of the new barriers that they've put up are considered replacement wall, meaning it's new 30 or 18 foot steel bollard fencing that is replacing smaller or older barriers. And the next challenge for the administration is to really try to make some headway in Texas, where the challenge is that almost all of the land where they plan to build is in private hands. So they're going to have to make aggressive use of eminent domain there in Texas to acquire that land and get this thing built in really now just a year.
You know, as a sort of a sidebar here, there's a nonprofit called We Build the Wall that's been crowdsourcing for border wall funding and taking it upon themselves to build parts of the wall on private property. But that, too, apparently is being challenged.
That's right. This is a group that's connected to Steve Bannon, the president's former advisor, as well as Chris Kobach, the immigration activist and former Kansas Secretary of State. And this private group says it's raised nearly $25 million to build. It aims to build about 30 miles of new barriers with private money, as you note. And they've completed one span right outside El Paso. And now they have broken ground on another in Mission, Texas, and the lower Rio Grande Valley. And a judge there has put a temporary restraining order on the project because the group lacks the permitted needs from the International Boundary and Water Commission. That is the group that must authorize any construction in the floodplain of the Rio Grande. And what's most controversial about this particular project that the group is trying to build is that it's a structure right on the floodplain of the Rio Grande, right next to the river. And that's raising concerns about its potential impact on flooding and, of course, the river.
Nick Miroff is an immigration reporter for The Washington Post. He's been covering the story of the border wall, and we'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Nick, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, David. Always good to be with you.
This week, leaders in the Texas capital city took the first steps in efforts to overhaul the code that determines what can be built where, something that hasn't been done since the 1980s. As we all know, Texas's capital city has grown quite a bit over the past four decades or so, and concerns over gentrification and skyrocketing house and rent prices have many in the community saying an overhaul of that land development code is way overdue. Megan Kimball has been writing about this for the Texas Observer, where she is senior editor. Megan, thanks so much for coming in and speaking with us on the Texas Standard. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Paint a picture for us. How much growth in the past four decades has the city of Austin experienced? Those who are listening to us in Dallas and Houston and the like.
So in 1984, which is the last time Austin updated its land development code, about 400,000 people lived in the city. Now about 2 million live in Austin and in the surrounding metro area. So the city itself is much larger, the population is larger, and housing costs have skyrocketed. So rents have gone up about 50% throughout the city. Home prices have quadrupled, while incomes have not matched the growth of those prices.
Okay, so what does it mean to update that code? And surely this is going to affect people who are living here already.
So what the code does is it says to builders what can be built next to what, where it can go, how much parking is required. And so essentially what the city is trying to do with this code is incentivize more density in Austin. And there are basically two ways to do that. You can allow more units to be built on a single parcel of land. And so in many residential neighborhoods, what they're trying to do is incentivize what's called missing middle housing. So instead of a single family house, they would create a duplex or a house and accessory dwelling unit in the back. And the other way to do that is to allow more density in our apartment buildings. And so along transit corridors, you can build more units if you provide affordable housing, and that will allow us to have a better transit network.
For people who are somewhat progressive in their outlook on this stuff, that sounds all fine and wonderful. But for people who are actually living in some of these communities that will be affected, their homes represent their retirement income. Their homes and what they've put into their communities represent something that they thought would be stable. So that seems to be a big part of the pushback, does it not?
Indeed, yeah. I think people are really fearful, understandably, of change coming to their neighborhoods because homes represent such an important wealth generator in our society. I think there's a lot of misinformation around what's actually going to happen to home prices. Likely, they will go up. That's also not really clear what's going to happen to them. But I think what happens is, so what the city is trying to do is what's called upzoning, which is allow for more density on a single parcel of land. But that doesn't mean that a person's home has to change. A homeowner would have to opt into changing their structure. And that, you know, you as a homeowner, you would have to decide to do that. And so if you decide to do nothing, if you say, I like my home, I don't want to change it, nothing will essentially change.
This isn't the first time in recent months in which the code city officials have tried to crack this code issue. Why was there a problem in the most recent go-round?
So in the last time around, it was a process called Code Next. And I think one reason that it didn't really reflect what the city intended to create was there were so many voices at the table, so many sort of contentious arguments around zoning, that it ended up being a document that didn't really accomplish what the city set out to do.
Very interesting. How long will this process continue here in Austin? Have they given a deadline?
So yesterday, City Council voted on their first reading of the code. It has to have three readings to pass. So people say that within early 2020, hopefully by February or March, they will have accomplished three readings. So still a lot is still getting worked out. There's a document right now that the City Council passed yesterday, but there are amendments to that document. They're still taking input from community. And so it still could very much change.
I mentioned earlier that the rest of the Lone Star State's trying to deal with growth. What we're seeing in Austin, is this a kind of canary in the coal mine for what's happening elsewhere?
Absolutely. So, you know, as you know, Texas cities are projected to grow enormously over the coming decades. And so I think every city in Texas is going to have to deal with, where do those people live? And the fundamental question from a climate perspective is, do they continue to sprawl into the outlying area, which destroys wetlands and trees and rivers and creates more roads and impervious cover that exacerbates flooding? Or are those people allowed to live in city cores near their jobs, near their schools, and have to drive less?
Megan Kimball has been writing about this for the Texas Observer, where she's senior editor. Megan, thanks so much for stopping by. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Let's check out what Texans are talking about on social media. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. We're hearing from our friends and listeners about the story at the top of the show, how a federal judge has moved to block Pentagon funds the Trump administration planned to use for border wall construction. A top comment on our Facebook page reads that Congress has the power of the purse. The executive can't reallocate funding. And Brad Emmons says this about the administration's reasoning for reallocating the funding. The national security argument they've used has always been weak, period. However, Dean Gobble writes that the judge in the ruling has overstepped their authority. We're also hearing from folks about the story we just heard, those issues of growth and affordability in Austin, paralleling several other issues in several other Texas cities. Makul Sadiq says sustainable development with parks and public transportation is the solution. Just one comment we're seeing today, David. I'll be back with more later in the program.
We'd love to hear what's making news on your radar. Tweet us right now, won't you? Texas at Texas Standard. You know how to find us on social media, right? Wells Dunbar knows how to find you. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
Business and your money on the Standard. Dallas-based Southwest Airlines has reached a settlement with airplane manufacturer Boeing over the grounding of its 737 MAX fleet, Dallas Morning News is reporting. The airline plans on giving $125 million from that settlement back to employees. Southwest owns more 737 MAX planes than any other airline, 34 in its fleet at the time it was grounded. 27 more planes are due to be delivered by the end of the year. The airline is reported to have lost more than $435 million in operating income through the third quarter of 2019 because of those grounded planes. The Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, announced Wednesday that the 737 MAX will not be recertified this year, and there's no official timeline for the planes to return to service.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The tidal wave of Californians heading to Texas shows no sign of slowing. A new survey indicating that some 700,000 left the Golden State last year and more than 86,000 of those California expats came to you know where. Here in Texas, we like to brag about how our state is number one, and the current state of the economy seems to be backing that claim. Indeed, if Texas were a country, its over $1.7 trillion economy would make it the 10th largest in the world. But as the state reaches new economic heights, some critics are saying, well, that there may be a limit on Texas's success. Say it ain't so. That's what Stephen Pettigo is finding as a professor at UT Austin in the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He's also the inaugural director of the LBJ Urban Lab. Professor, thanks for joining us here on the Texas Standard. Good to see you, sir.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. So what have you found at the Urban Lab that might contradict this narrative of Texas's ongoing success?
Well, I think as you illustrated in the introduction here, Texas is seeing extreme growth. We are one of the largest economies in the world. We have some of the lowest unemployment in the world. And if you look at Chief Executive Magazine, they said that we are the best business climate. But if you look, dive a little bit deeper into sort of some of the metrics about the types of jobs, the types of education attainment levels that Texans have, I think what we start to find is a bit of a gap here. And so in the piece that I wrote for the Dallas Morning News, the real thing I was questioning, not really a critic of growth, but was just sort of asking this question about if we are thinking about growth for the future as a state that's expanding so fast, how do we think about ensuring that more people can participate in our economy?
What does that mean when you say more people participate in our economy? Presumably, if you have more people coming to Texas, you have more entrepreneurs among that group. You know, people are coming here because we tend to have a regulatory environment that is, as our leaders like to tell us, good for business, good for growth.
That
right?
is true. But I would say this. I mean, one of the things that we know that drives economic development today is people, right? Having the skills. And so the question really is how much more of our talent and businesses can Texas import? And why not focus on creating opportunities for Texans that are here? So one of the things that I write in the piece is that we've built this fantastic foundation of growth. So let's think more about how we get our residents the skills, the training, the necessary skills to really participate in this economy. And that's rethinking about some of our training programs in our high schools, and our vocational programs, all those types of things, really giving people that opportunity to participate.
Let me ask you, I want to take this out of Texas for just a moment, just by way of illustration. Let's say that we are in Arkansas. All right. And we want to do something to train our people so that they'll be ready for the great jobs here in Arkansas. Now, we're training these folks. We're making a huge investment in education, for example. And when they graduate, where are they going to go? Do you think they're going to stay in Arkansas? Now, my question would be for Texas. Why make this kind of investment that perhaps you seem to be suggesting if, in fact, we're going to see a lot of brain drain? We're going to see folks go into California, to Silicon Valley, to other places which might be more attractive.
Well, this is the whole point. If we can create opportunity here, we don't have the brain, we won't experience the brain drain. And so one of the things I write in the piece is that let's focus on growing Texas businesses. Let's focus on this idea of creating entrepreneurship, mentorship programs, investing back into our businesses here that can employ local Texans. And so, you know, if you think about economic development or what drives growth, we say there are three things you really want to invest in: people and enterprises and place. And if you do all three of those things, the hope is that we don't have the issue that you just described in Arkansas. And one could argue that the reason that a state like Arkansas experiences brain drain to the state of Texas is because there is opportunity here. My point in the piece is that if we really want to think about how we grow sustainably, how we manage growth, how we create opportunity, this question of equity in our communities, we have to invest back into our local communities. That's people, that's places, and that's enterprises. That's local Texans.
I love what you're saying. Don't get me wrong. I'm just sort of playing devil's advocate here. What is, of those three factors that you're just talking about, is it the people that's more important? Is it the place that's more important? Or is it the opportunity, that pre-existing opportunity, that's the most important, if you look at where these opportunities are happening?
Yeah, this is the challenging question about deciding how you define what drives growth. For some communities, it's about investing in the enterprise development. How do you create the businesses that can create opportunities for the residents that you have? For places like Austin, we're having to think about upskilling our talent, giving people technical programs to participate in this technology economy that
we're
growing here.
You just don't have the people to actually fill the jobs.
And then in some of our cities and in our rural communities, we really have to invest back into place. Many of our rural communities that write in the piece lack the infrastructure to participate in the digital economy. We need broadband in our communities. We have to think about this idea that we can't just expect retail and tourism development to save our rural communities and our cities. As you know, we're here in Austin, Texas. We're a city that's experiencing extreme growth. We have to think about affordability, our land use, our transportation. It depends a lot of times where you are in the state. And so the point of the piece is that, look, you can't have a one-size-fits-all economic development strategy. You have to have something that's tailored. My point is this, is as we think about a state going first, let's think about what are the investments that are needed to make in our state here, mm-hmm. as opposed to putting additional dollars and incentives and companies and people that are outside of the state.
You know how things work, though. I mean, before things change often, the situation has to start going downhill. Now, what I'm wondering is there a way to avoid the tipping point that would be that downhill slope?
Well, this is the opportunity for Texas. Now, we're not in a decline. We are a state that we're obviously a state that's growing really quickly and really fastly. It is incumbent of us now to manage the growth or let the growth manage us. We don't want the growth to manage us. We want to manage growth. So this is really the time to get ahead of that curve where we don't start to see that decline that you're suggesting.
Have we already reached a tipping point in some places? Because growth has been so great. I mean, we were talking about Central Texas here because that's where we are. We are all experiencing the traffic situation, for example. Aren't too many other places to build roads, and people have been trying to come up with mass transit answers, and none of those seem to be moving forward. So I'm wondering if we're already starting to see this, I don't want to use tipping point again, but we're already starting to see some limits.
I think we are, David, and I think what you're getting at is this really interesting point for Texans. And that is, while we are a state that has to think about our rural communities and think about the development and how we bring those rural communities along, for the first time, Texas has to understand that it is a metropolitan state. It is a state that is more urban than it's ever been before.
Right.
So that means that we have to think about how we manage these issues in our commerce centers. Because if we want to bring urban communities along, if we want to bring rural communities along, it really is about investing back into the places that are these engines. And some of our engines, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, and Austin are experiencing this growth. And so now it's trying to, again, manage it or let it manage us.
These are the issues that Stephen Pedigo has been thinking an awful lot about as the inaugural director of the LBJ Urban Lab. He's a professor at UT Austin in the LBJ School of Public Affairs. Professor, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Funeral services are underway for a Houston police officer fatally shot this past weekend while responding to a report of domestic violence. Mourners are gathered at Grace Church to remember 32-year-old Sergeant Christopher Brewster. U.S. wind farm capacity has surged above 100 gigawatts for the first time, according to the latest data from the Department of Energy. As KUT's Mose Bouchel reports, Texas remains the top producer.
So 1 gigawatt can power around 700,000 homes, depending on electricity use, and Texas can produce nearly 27 gigawatts of wind power. That's 3 times more than the next closest state. It's all thanks to big transmission lines that the state built out a little over 10 years ago now that helped bring wind energy from wind farms in West Texas to urban centers in the east. Now, while Texas produces more wind power than any other state, it doesn't have wind as the largest percentage of its electric use. That distinction goes to Iowa, where 37% of electricity produced comes from wind power.
KUT's Mose Bouchel reporting. Former White House doctor Ronnie Jackson is making his case to represent the 13th congressional district in the Texas Panhandle. President Trump's one-time nominee to be Secretary of Veterans Affairs announced earlier this week he's running to replace retiring Republican U.S. Representative Mac Thornberry. Jackson told Fox News Channel today he could have run in other parts of Texas.
Leaving the Navy, I could have moved back to anywhere in Texas mm-hmm. that I wanted, but this is the region of Texas that I consider my home, and these are the people that mm-hmm. I understand, the people that I know, and these are the people that I think I can effectively represent.
The Texas Tribune reports Jackson is from a town located outside the 13th District. Congressman Thornberry has previously expressed frustration with out-of-district candidates seeking to represent his constituents. Jackson is one of about a dozen Republicans in the primary. And the number of children under 6 years old without health coverage is on the rise after years of steady decline. That's according to a report out Wednesday from the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. One of the co-authors, Elizabeth Burrock, described the findings.
14 states have rates of uninsured young children that are higher than the national average of 4.3%.
One of those states is Texas, which has the second highest in uninsured rate for young children in the country at 8.3%. That's behind Alaska's 9.2%. A newscast item yesterday incorrectly stated there are 11 contenders in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate in Texas. 12 candidates have filed, according to the Texas Secretary of State's website. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves, but drink with others. SierraNevada.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Cyber hacks, stolen account information, ransomware. Sometimes it feels like every week brings a new story about how our data has been compromised by bad actors. Sadly, 2019 was a banner year for cyber breaches affecting mobile devices, medical records, government infrastructure, and a whole lot more. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga is here to remind us of some of this past year's most important cybercrime stories. Hello there, Omar.
Hey, David, it is dangerous out there.
It is indeed. I thought we were supposed to keep up the cheer and all that kind of stuff that goes along with the holiday season. We got to start talking about cybercrime, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that we kind of have gotten so used to hearing about these things that you actually don't hear about them very much anymore. When a lot of these breaches happen, they kind of make the tech round news, but they don't go mainstream. So yeah, it's actually still happening a lot, and we just don't hear as much about it.
That's a really good point, because I think a lot of people sort of tune it out too. Let's begin with WhatsApp, though, because this is becoming more and more popular, messaging app, and a hack last spring that may be more important than many folks might have realized to begin with, right?
Yeah, this was one that was reported back in May, and it was actually surveillance software that was installed on people's phones. So it's one of those things where you might not even know that you were a victim to this because it's keeping track of you, but not necessarily crashing the app or stealing information. There's about 1.5 billion WhatsApp users, so we really don't know how many people have been affected by this one. But this was one of a couple of hacks this year that kind of exposed systems like iOS, like Apple's iOS, which has been considered, you know, much more secure than other systems, but even those are getting breached pretty heavily.
Well, you're talking about iOS. An incident that might not seem to affect us directly here in Texas involves the iPhone. Tell us a little bit about the cyber attacks that targeted Uyghurs in China.
Yeah, this was one that Google's Project Zero detected, and it was one that was actually more like a phishing attack where specific websites were set up to expose a vulnerability in iPhones. And Apple, you know, when it was discovered, they issued an update within, I think, about 10 days, and really downplayed it and said, you know, this was very targeted toward a specific group of people by the Chinese government and won't affect most of our users. But again, it exposes that these things are possible, that it is possible to hack iOS, that it is possible to put websites out there that are hacked that can expose these vulnerabilities, and even Apple can't keep up.
Texans definitely felt the consequences of a ransomware attack on some government computer systems. I think a lot of our listeners recall that. Tell us a little bit more about what is ransomware and whether or not it really led to an impact on Texas in these attacks.
Yeah, I remember we talked about this back in August on Texas Standard. This was an attack from hackers that were actually demanding money, and I believe it was in the form of Bitcoin. They were demanding a specific amount of money in order to unlock these systems that they had taken control of, and I think it was something like 22 or 23 Texas agencies. I think there was some back and forth with like a counter offer of like, oh no, we'll give you this much, and like, no. And that's happened in other states. I'd heard about something like this in Massachusetts where they were kind of like going back and forth on what the offer should be, but I think in Texas we just flat out refused to pay it. But they're still investigating that. So yeah, that the ransomware is typically sort of a hijacking of a system and then a demand for Bitcoin or what have you in order to unlock it.
Some municipalities, some locations fared better than others because they took quick action as soon as they realized something had gone wrong.
Yeah, and the danger here is that a lot of it was very outdated systems, you know, systems using old versions of Windows that had never been updated, that are not even supported anymore. So it kind of goes to the whole issue of updating the infrastructure within the state, that there's a lot of old systems still in place that are much more vulnerable.
Sometimes data thieves target contractors as a way of getting data held by government agencies. Isn't that what happened with Customs and Border Protection earlier this year?
Yeah, this one emerged in May that a Tennessee-based contractor called Perceptix that was collecting data from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection system was hacked. And so it exposed something like 100,000 photos that are taken during these border patrol checks. It goes to a big issue that we've seen this year in the supply chain, is that it might not necessarily be a big entity that's attacked. It's something down the supply chain of a contractor or someone who works with them that is exposed. And then that leads to a big problem for the agency itself.
You know, we've been talking about the year that was. We're basically out of time, but I have to ask, any predictions for cybersecurity in 2020?
There's supposed to be some new standards issued by the government, I think in January, that are supposed to tighten up security, at least for contractors, and that may help. But I mean, I don't see a quick fix for any of this. I think it's going to keep happening and, you know, affect private business and government entities and state agencies. I mean, it's just going to be another year of bad attacks, and hopefully they won't affect a lot of us personally.
And of course, there's an election coming up. So,
and then there's that.
Yeah, right. So yeah, let's not let our guard down just yet. Omar Gayaga talks tech over at techminutetexas.com. Thanks so much for bringing us the holiday cheer, Omar.
Sorry the news isn't better, David, but I appreciate it.
Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology. With more than 210 cancer centers across the state, patients can access technology, research, and treatment options in their local communities. More at texasoncology.com.
Hey, you got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Many folks we know love Western-style cowboy and cowgirl boots, but sometimes when you grow up somewhere that isn't Texas, it can be difficult to explain that passion. Fortunately, lots of boot-loving musicians travel through Texas and even wind up putting down roots here in the Lone Star State, and it's here that they can express their love for the boot more freely. One of these musicians talked to us for our segment called From Heel to Toe, Stories About Texans and their boots.
Hey, I'm Cindy Cashdollar. I grew up in Woodstock, New York. Having a career in music, it's, of course, people think you made it up. That is actually my real name. Well, I play slide guitar and steel guitar. I've played many different styles of music with people. I guess I think of it as a voice in the way that it's played, with a slide bar and some vibrato to sustain notes, and how to fit in to best complement whoever I'm working with. And so it's inspiring. You just try and catch a wave and go with it and see where you can fit in, where you're not cluttering and where you're supporting everything. I moved here in 1992 because I was hired to work with Ray Benson and Asleep at the Wheel. So I got to know so much of Texas just through working and touring with Asleep at the Wheel, and all the people along the way that I met that we also worked with, Lyle Lovett and Willie Nelson, and on. So I think I got quite an education.
I never knew the art of making love.
Even when I first moved here, I had never even seen a barbecue menu. And I remember having to meet Ray for the very first time at Art's Rib House for lunch, and opening up the menu and just being like too nervous to admit that I didn't know what brisket was, or taking pants to the, you know, my show my stage wear pants with a dry cleaner and realizing that you had to tell them no starch or else they would crease the pants up the front so much you'd have to get your hand up in there inside the pant leg to peel it apart, you know. And boots, of course, I love cowboy boots, so I've worn cowboy boots since I was in high school, even in New York State. I think boots, especially Western boots, are artwork. They're pieces of artwork to me. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Texas Standard. This is Cindy Cashdollar. So happy to have been here. Thanks so much.
What a terrific player, Cindy Cashdollar. Hey, what's your boot story? What do your boots mean to you? Share it. It may be the next pair on the air. Email us, texasstandard.org.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
The woman who co-founded the United Farm Workers Union and coined the rallying cry, Si Se Puede, is getting recognition in a new traveling exhibit at Houston's Holocaust Museum. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovall sat down with Dolores Huerta and some of the local leaders she's inspired.
Long before President Obama campaigned with the phrase, "Yes, we can," Dolores Huerta stood with migrant farm workers and said, "Sí, se puede." At a spry 89 years old, she hypes up a crowd at the Houston Holocaust Museum. There, a traveling Smithsonian exhibit tells the story of her civil rights work through photos, poetry, video, and art.
The plight of farm labor in California is probably one of the most studied and investigated subjects in the annals of human suffering.
If you don't get together and take a direct, nonviolent action, then nothing changes, and you can't wait for somebody to come and do it for you. You've got to stand up and do it for yourself.
The exhibit dials in on Huerta's advocacy for California's migrant farm workers. Huerta co-founded the United Farm Workers Union alongside Cesar Chavez. Through that and decades of collective action, the union managed to gain a number of protections. But Huerta says it's not enough.
When people see the photo exhibit that we have here at the Holocaust Museum, and they see the victories that we won for farm workers, unfortunately, those do not go across the whole country. Some of them do, like having toilets in the fields, which of course we didn't have for people, having potable drinking water.
Other protections for farm workers, like unemployment insurance and the right to unionize, apply to California, but not Texas and most other states. But Huerta is hopeful about the advocacy happening today that incorporates racial and gender equality, immigrant and LGBTQ rights.
I like to say to people, if you're sorry you missed the 60s, we're back. Okay. And so I think you see that happening now. And of course, now we can add that we have a very strong immigrant rights movement.
Huerta also inspired some activists within that movement and a new guard of Latina leaders like Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo.
When it came time for me to be an advocate and to raise awareness about the issues that were important, I knew that a woman could carry a bullhorn. I knew that a woman could speak up and raise her voice because of that example.
Hidalgo says Dolores Huerta has inspired her since she was a kid and continues to do so.
She continues the fight. You know, there's no victory without a fight. And even today, she had us chanting, "Si se puede." And what a joy, you know, to chant with her. So that's what we have to remember. You never fully win. You never fully lose. You just keep fighting for what you believe in.
Yvette Mayo is a Latina career coach in Houston. She wears a Dolores Huerta pin on her jean jacket.
My story with Dolores is a long story. She's been my shero for a really long time.
She says a couple years ago, she went to Huerta for advice on her coaching business.
Long and short of it, she said to me, "I love what you're doing, but you need to do two things. One," she says, "you need to continue the education process, but I want you to bring younger women into it. We need to start earlier about the message of boldness and courage. And secondly, you should consider doing a nonprofit."
Mayo listened and started the nonprofit earlier this year.
And the training program has now trained 210 women, professional women in careers and corporate Houston.
Mayo says she hopes others are also inspired by Dolores Huerta. She's planning to come back to the exhibit with her granddaughter before it closes in February. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Troval for the Texas Standard.
We are fast approaching 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. And wait a minute, we haven't heard from you. Let us know what's on your news radar. Just tweet us at Texas Standard. You know, Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, is going to be giving us an update on what Texans are talking about in just a minute.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Perhaps lost in the focus on impeachment was a rare agreement between the president and the U.S. House of Representatives Tuesday, the Democratic majority voting to support the president's plan to rework NAFTA in favor of an updated trade deal between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. That tripartite agreement was initially designed to break down barriers to economic activity between the three. In fact, there's a visa known as a trade NAFTA or TN visa that helps American farms bring in Mexican engineers and veterinarians to work as animal scientists, which sounds fine until you look a little more closely at what's actually happening. Reporter Maria Perez of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has been investigating what appears to be a misuse of that program. Maria, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Let's begin with this trade NAFTA visa. What was it created to do exactly? How is it supposed to be used?
This visa is supposed to allow professionals in Mexico, the U.S., and Canada to move freely so that Canadians and Mexicans who are professionals would be able to come into the U.S. and work more freely, just like barriers to trade had been lowered.
But as I understand it, you found that the way these are being used down on the farm is a little bit, it looks like they're bending the rules somewhat.
Correct. Right now, U.S. dairy farms are having a lot of trouble to find low-cost workforce. The labor market is very tight. Mm-hmm. What some farms are doing is classifying these workers, these engineers and veterinarians that are coming from Mexico as animalic scientists so that they can bring them with that visa. But then once they arrive here, the jobs that they perform are actually milking cows, cleaning barns, and other menial tasks that don't require a college degree, which is a requirement of this visa program.
So they're trying to deal with a tight job market by basically using these visas, but presumably they would have had to have promised these workers something. They wouldn't just come over for nothing, right? I mean, what sort of promises were these highly trained and skilled workers from Mexico being given?
Correct. Most of them were told that they were going to be coming here to work as animal scientists, to oversee nutrition programs, healthcare of the animals, and their hope was that they would, even that if the salaries are low in comparison with what American dairy scientists, that would allow them to gain experience and maybe like to grow professionally, but that did not happen because once they came here, they found that the job was very different from what they were promised.
Are there penalties if farms do this sort of thing, sort of luring with a better job than what they ultimately get? Or, I mean, what is the government doing when it comes to regulation?
Well, actually, we don't know. Yes, there is a crime. There is a crime called fraud in labor contracting. So if you hire a foreigner promising different job conditions that you were intended to fulfill, that's a crime that punishes that. And there cannot be other sorts of regulations. We could be getting in a territory of visa fraud. But as to what the government is doing and how these rules are being enforced, we simply don't know. The Department of Homeland Security, through ICE, they have a division, which is Homeland Security Investigations, that investigates this type of cases. Right. I asked them how many complaints and how many cases they had opened. They would not give me that information. The State Department also, I asked them about whether they have data about the number of workers employed by farms, and they have denied that information. I also asked him questions about whether they had received complaints. They have not answered my questions. So that's something that we are still working on to get answers to the questions that we have.
Maria Perez is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Maria, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. All right, one last opportunity to check in with the talk of Texas, as it were. Social media editor Wells Dunbar is here. And what are you hearing?
Hey, David. Well, no big surprise, but impeachment's still the talk of the land.
Don't say.
Yeah, shocker, I know. But here's a related story yesterday that kind of flew under the radar yet is a buzz on Twitter and elsewhere. Don't know if you heard this one. Texas Representative Louie Gohmert publicly named the alleged whistleblower at the center of Trump's impeachment woes yesterday. And this actually happened.
He didn't say that person was the whistleblower.
Did not single them out, per se, but this did happen on the record there at the House Judiciary Committee in their meeting discussing impeachment, objecting to the proceedings, Representative Gohmert rattled off a list of witnesses he wanted to see testify instead, which included the person alleged to be the whistleblower in right-wing media. So lots of folks chiming in about that one.
I bet.
On our Facebook page, Jane Hensley says, if anything happens to the whistleblower, Gohmert should face charges. And Tyler Malloy says that whistleblower protection laws need to be enforced. Attacking the person who pulled the fire alarm does not look good on the Republican side, especially when they aren't even trying to put out the fire.
Seems like there's a bit of a charade going on here, since everyone seems to know the name.
Yeah.
Because so what is the game here? If everyone knows the name is kind of out there publicly.
I don't know the name. I haven't.
No?
No.
Okay, well, it's out there.
Yeah, no,
it's
it is. Out,
it's definitely, true. That's why people are talking about
exactly.
it. That's why they, and you know, does, most news organizations have chosen for the reasons stated by, and that's the same with us.
And we've seen the previous stuff with other people who have, testified in opposition. Some people have had to say they've had to go into hiding amid threats. So lots of people, concerned about this move. And it just really, the rancor that we're continuing to see, not a big surprise, but still, you hate to see it, folks. Well, here's a story from earlier in the program. People are continuing to chime in about the brawl over a new land development code in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Those opposed say the new rules would hurt quality of life, while the folks in favor say it would boost affordability. And, really, it's an issue that affects cities across the state, all of Texas urban areas. And folks are chiming in about development, affordability, and the like. Via Facebook, Jennifer Potter Miller says, we're glad to be making progress on this after the last election. It gave the local officials a clear mandate. Housing policy is climate policy, and we can't pretend the city is going to look the same in 20 years when it's literally getting hotter every year. Meanwhile, Ann Herbert, she says that people are not against density, and of course, everyone wants affordability. They just want it in a way that is thoughtful and not rushed. So again, issues that have been, playing out here in Austin for, when did I move here? 95? Playing out in here for a long time. But most recently with this code revision very intensely over the last year or so. But again, issues that, big Texas metropolitan cores are all increasingly dealing with.
Growth, growth, growth.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a lot of people saying, let the growth continue. I'm not sure that there are many people saying stop the growth per se, however. So that's kind of an interesting approach. Alas, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.